from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, according to a recent analysis of the latest census data, more than 80% of Bay Area police forces have a disproportionate number of white officers relative to the racial makeup of the communities they serve. The disparity is stark in Daly City, for example, which has a white population of just 14%, but 100% of the police force is white. And as the nation's attention focuses on issues of police and race in the wake of events in Ferguson, Missouri, we look at how the racial composition of our local police forces affects arrests and public trust in the criminal justice system. Forum is up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With the death of a young African-American, Michael Brown, in Ferguson, Missouri, from shots by a white police officer and images of protests with black residents and almost all white police officers, a national debate is on about race and policing. The diverse and politically progressive Bay Area seems like a different world than Ferguson, Missouri, but a new U.S. census reveals that over 80% of the larger cities here have a higher percentage of white police officers than the percentages within the cities of white residents. This morning's opening forum hour, we want to look at ratios of white police in Bay Area communities to citizens of color and what the numbers mean. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We want to welcome first Judge Ladoris Cordell, who is an independent police auditor in the city of San Jose. Previously, she was a Santa Clara County Superior Court judge and a Palo Alto City Councilwoman. And Judge Cordell, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Justin McCrary, who's here with us in studio, professor of law at UC Berkeley. He's also director of the D-Lab, Berkeley's Big Data Initiative, and co-director of the Crime Working Group of the National Bureau of Economic Research. Welcome, Justin McCrary.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And I want to begin, Judge Cordell, with you, if I may. And you've said that really pretty much being in the world of San Jose and seeing how things operate there is a kind of microcosm for the United States. And from these latest statistics, we learned that 63% of the estimated police officers are white in San Jose, and the population is 27%. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Well, I'm talking about that, but additionally, there are other issues. There are other issues that combine to make this a matter worthy of national discussion, if not local discussion. So if you look at all of the stats for San Jose Police Department, and San Jose is the 10th largest city in the United States, if you look at the demographics generally, if we talk about the African-American population, the Latino population, San Jose Police Department is doing pretty well. So it isn't – the issue isn't just that there are more white officers. They're disproportionate to their numbers in the population. It's a matter of policing and what this says to communities where these officers are in communities of color. How do they police? What is the relationship between those who are not white, who are in communities of color? And that's really what's given rise to this discussion. And I really think that what happened in Ferguson was really the tipping point. Everything just kind of boiled over because these issues are not just significant only to Ferguson. They're significant to police departments and communities throughout the country.
There is an argument that's been framed that you really ought to have police officers who look like the communities they serve or speak the language, if it happens to be Spanish, that those in the community speak. But there's another argument that it has more to do with how the police serve the community and how their ties are connected to the community. In other words, how much are they trusted beyond what color their face is and what race they are? Where do you stand on that, or is it some combination of the two?
It is indeed a combination of both. So I believe that if we could in this country get back to community policing, where officers are required to stay out of their cars for most of their shifts, so they're interacting with the public and getting to know their communities, that's a way to start to bridge the gap and to alleviate or to build up the trust. But there's more than that.
Isn't community policing coming back, though, to some degree?
Well, to some extent, but for example, in San Jose, because officers are resigning and leaving because of their concerns about pension reform, that's a police department that just isn't equipped to get to do community policing. The hope is that it is on the rebound. It is coming back. You know, it's sort of like, you know, we're back to doing something that was very popular, you know, many years ago, and now here we are again. So part of it is that, and part of it is who they look like. It is no question that you know, there's a comfort level if people know that the people who are giving them orders, who have the authority, have had similar experiences, have similar backgrounds. There's better understanding when they talk to one another, especially those, for example, who are primarily Spanish-speaking. If you have officers who are Spanish-speaking as well, that is very significant to communicating and to building trust.
There is, however, Justin McCrary, let me bring this into you, this whole problem of recruitment, especially among, say, African-American youth who don't necessarily always trust the police officers and don't necessarily have the highest regard for police. And there's also the concern that the testing and the exams and what they have to go through in the way of admission is a problem as well.
I think it's right that basically every police department thinks it could do better in terms of diversity and actively is trying to do better in terms of diversity. But you're right, the police departments operate under a lot of constraints. They're legally obliged to utilize some sort of an entrance examination. And that entrance examination oftentimes has a component to it that mimics something like what you might think of as a basic achievement test. So one of the challenges for coming up with a racially and ethnically diverse police force is the same as the challenge of coming up with, say, for example, college freshmen that are mimicking the faces of America. And we have that challenge in higher education, and in many ways, police departments have the same type of battle.
Well, when you have predominantly white police departments, you often have a culture that's reflective of that. I mean, this is of great concern in this whole question. How much does the culture really tend to, or as Judge Cordell suggested, really attend to the needs of the community and really think of police work as serving, protecting and serving?
No doubt. And I think that's part of what is now, I think, more in the water in police departments in terms of the underlying police culture than was certainly with respect to police departments a long time ago. In my own research, I focused on the trend in police hiring in terms of diversity of the workforce going back to 1960. And if you compare police department culture today to police department culture in, say, 1970, it's not even close. So we're clearly doing better as a society. That being said, I think if you asked any police chief, they would say that we could probably still do better. And that consists of primarily training and outreach and trying to operate within the legal confines that the police departments are operating under.
But why are there so many imbalance problems, particularly in the light of all the civil rights legislation and all the lawsuits and all the consent decrees? I mean, you would think that there would be major kind of diversity all over the place, but there isn't.
Well, the specific issue of lawsuits against police departments alleging violations of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as amended was specifically what I've focused on in my own research. And it's absolutely right that the diversity of police department improves in the wake of litigation. For example, if you focus on hiring discrimination against African Americans, if you look at the numbers of African Americans, they rise in the police department following that. There's a broader question of whether that's something that is necessary for diversity to improve. I don't think that's quite right. Diversity does improve even in the absence of litigation, but litigation does seem to be a powerful force for that.
Justin McCrary is professor of law at UC Berkeley, and Diane Urban is with us. She's chief of the Hayward Police Force. And Chief Urban, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let's talk first about recruitment. I know that most police officers and most police chiefs want a diverse force. Some of the figures that appeared in the San Jose Mercury News don't necessarily conform to actually the numbers that have been changing because they're based on census statistics. But what do you do about recruitment?
Well, unfortunately, right now across the country, and not alone just to the state of California, we are all competing for a very small pool of qualified candidates. You know, the pendulum swings. When I left the San Jose Police Department a little over 3 years ago, I was a part of the command staff that was handing out 80 pink slips, and now that's a police department that can't actually, because of other things going on there, really can't fill their slots. Here in Hayward, we're very well funded. We're very well supported by both the community and council. Yet getting people through that very comprehensive background, polygraph, medical, psychological has been our greatest challenge. And so getting qualified candidates in general, we're competing against every police department locally and statewide.
So what are your numbers? I mean, how do they break down in terms of officers who are of color?
So we're 193 sworn if we were fully staffed, and right now we're at about 21% Hispanic, 11% Asian, 9% African American, and 59% white. And about 4 months ago, we stood up a new recruiting unit, and we've already been participated in about eight recruiting events. And we've done a lot of outreach. We're lucky. We have both Chabot Junior College and Cal State East Bay in our community, and we have a very active chapter of the local NAACP. And so in partnerships, there's a commitment for this organization to really reflect what the community looks like. But as both Judge Cordell and Justin spoke about, it is an incredible challenge getting qualified candidates in general, and particularly of ethnic and cultural diversity.
So it's safe to say you are not reflecting the community now, as is true in so many big cities.
We're pretty close. I think we've been doing a good job, but you stated it yourself, Michael. I think there isn't a chief that's being honest that doesn't want a department that really accurately reflects a community. But please bear in mind that communities are constantly changing. And so, you know, you might have this decade a large Hispanic population, and a decade from now you might have a much higher African American population. Here in Hayward, we have about 53% Hispanic, and so we work very diligently to bring bilingual officers on board so that there is that nexus and that communication ability. But I don't want to overlook what I think is probably the most important component. Judge Cordell spoke about it. Community policing, I was concerned to hear her say and to hear you speak about it. Is it coming back? Well, I'll tell you something. This police department has never lost community policing. It is a part of the very fiber of what we do, everything that we do. It, and all of our officers do beat projects. There's a tremendous amount of connection with the community. We're very, very well supported. We do a lot of events in the community. We run a huge youth baseball program during the summer. We had over 800 kids participating. Coffee with cops. We have two substations here. It is expected, regardless of color, race, communication, that our police officers are a part of the everyday community here.
When you're working with youth, do you consider, for example, as far as recruitment, getting into the middle and the high schools, or do you?
We do. We do. And in fact, we're very fortunate. We have a very robust Police Explorer program. And over the last year, we've been exploring some grant funding opportunities to grow that. I'm very focused on hiring people that come from within the community. I'll tell you, in the 3 years that I've been chief, about half of the people that I have been able to hire, both on the professional and sworn side, have been people that come from the Hayward community itself. And that goes right into loyalty and commitment to staying with an organization. It is not uncommon now where an officer will organization hop. They'll go where benefits are better, where salaries are better, and we're very focused on people doing long-term careers here. And I don't want to overlook the fact a police department isn't just made up of sworn personnel. In Hayward, one-third of my organization is professional staff, and we work very diligently to have that professional staff be reflective of the community as well. So from people in records, our counselors in our Youth Family Services Bureau, our community service officers, the folks who work at the shelter and in police and fire dispatch, we work to have diversity in those ranks as well because they're interacting and communicating and providing customer service to the community as well.
Dan Urban is Chief of the Hayward Police. Chief Urban, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Michael. My pleasure.
Good to have you. And we're going to talk to another police chief in just a moment. But let me go back, if I may, to Judge Cordell. Judge Doris Cordell, again, is independent police auditor with the city of San Jose. When we just heard from Chief Urban mentioning the changes in the community, the demographic changes, a lot of these play into the whole calculus of this. I mean, I ought to mention that in 1990, Ferguson, Missouri was three-quarters white, and by 2010, it was two-thirds black. So the racial makeup in terms of legacy and changing and flux is a big part of what we're talking about, isn't it, Judge?
Sure. But, you know, I want to stress that I greatly appreciate the work that Chief Urban is doing in Hayward. But this is about more than numbers. This is about when you bring officers on and you've done a good job recruiting, this is about training. It is the case that if you live in America, you have biases. And the biggest bias people have all colors is race. Race is the most misunderstood and least understood issue in this country. And the training of officers to have them understand that all of us have these unconscious biases that surface. There have been studies that showed when white officers face suspects or individuals, not even suspects, who are dark-skinned. The darker the skin, the more the anxiety level goes up among white officers, because there's a perception of relating that really dark skin to being something bad or criminal. There are studies that have been done that show, and this isn't just white officers. There are officers of color. Everyone, we all have biases. But the question is, what are we doing? What are we doing when we do all this good recruiting and bring officers in to adequately train them to deal with these issues so that they're not, you know, apt to think negatively of someone because of how they look?
Chris, there's also the problem that I've heard. I mean, I'm sorry, but it just occurred to me that I needed to say this because it's been said on this program. I've had African-American youth say that they've had more trouble in some instances with African-American police officers, that they're tougher on them and more harsh on them. I mean, sometimes it has to do more, doesn't it, with the training and instilling trust somehow through that training?
Sure. I mean, it's a combination of many things, but I just want it clear that the hardest part is recognizing one's own biases, especially if you're a police officer, you've got a gun and a badge. It is so important that you understand how you think and how what you do, what happens to you when you look at certain individuals. So the issue at hand, however, are the shootings of unarmed young African-American men. That's really been the national discussion, and not just Ferguson and New York, and it's all around, and also Latinos. So that's really the question that that has raised all of this to a level of national discussion, and it really talks to this issue of race that everyone either gets very defensive about or goes into denial and, you know, well, it's not an issue, and why can't we be colorblind? I actually had an officer tell me once, he said, when I look at people, I don't see color. That's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. I mean, that's being in denial. I'm sure he meant well, but that's not the case. It just isn't. So we have to get comfortable with talking about this issue and trying to better understand how pervasive our biases are just based on the melanin or lack thereof in our skin.
And Jesse McCrary, what do we do about those biases? I mean, when it comes to training, you have the whole range of judging danger and arresting under what circumstances, all of those kinds of things. But biases are hard to vanquish. Biases, especially the kind that the judge is talking about, are hard to ameliorate.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that's not actually my area of expertise. I'd commend to you my colleague Vicky Plout, who actually studies the subject in some detail. But I think training is probably the only type of tool that the police department could utilize in that regard. Whether we have some sort of a national impetus to engage in widespread training along those lines, we're not going to see anything like that. Police departments are organized locally, and to a great extent, what we see happening with respect to police departments nationally is the product of thousands upon thousands of departments across the country, each making their own decisions about the extent to which they need to engage in more training or just to do exactly like they did last year.
And let me bring Alwin Brown into this discussion. He's Deputy Chief of the City of Richmond Police Department and the Mercury News, which did an extensive study of numbers throughout big Bay Area cities. Says that Richmond has a white population of 18% and 57% of the police are white. Let's talk about that with you, Deputy Chief Brown. And again, Alwin Brown is with us by phone here. Those numbers, they conform to your own analysis and your own taking stock?
Well, good morning. It's good to be with you. Actually, those numbers aren't accurate. So, you know, we have an authorized sworn strength in our department of 195 police officers, but right now we currently have 182 active. So of that 182 active, 40% of our officers are white. The remaining 60% represent officers from minority groups.
Well, let me get back to the point that's been emphasized here, that maybe race is not even necessarily as important as things like, although it's important, obviously, of paramount importance, but one has to factor in community policing and the importance of community policing and the training of police and the way that the police are tied to the community.
Yeah, so here in Richmond, we're still perfecting a system that we put in place some 8 years ago that really centers on police building strong, relationships and partnerships with the communities. We emphasize keeping the same beat officers in the same neighborhoods for longer periods of time. So they do develop relationships of trust, which enable communication back and forth, and for officers to work more closely in solving neighborhood problems at the neighborhood level with community members. We think that that foundation has been significantly important and played a big role in our ability to help drive down crime.
How do you measure that qualitatively? I mean, is it just measured in the statistics of how crime goes down? I mean, you've got the concern about trust and building trust, but how do you quantify it?
Well, we look at crime stats. We also get, you know, we're pretty open and transparent about, you know, our operations here. We have multiple connections to communities and stakeholders, and we get regular feedback on how our officers are doing. So it's not hard for people to reach out and tell us what they think, or if there's a problem, it's not hard for folks to make a complaint. And then we're pretty aggressive about taking the appropriate corrective action if that becomes necessary. But we feel like today we have the best relationship between police and community that we've had in decades here in Richmond.
And that means police of whatever color?
Certainly. So I think a big part of this is really valuing diversity and inclusion. And when I talk about diversity, I'm talking about policies and practices that really seek to include people who are considered some way different from traditional members. And when I talk about inclusion, I'm talking about fostering a culture that really values and uses the talents of all members. And I think that that's something that we've created and, of course, are working to perfect here in Richmond. So we do have a very diverse workforce. And just like in Hayward, about another third of our police force are professional employees, you know, who do things from code enforcement to telecommunications, operate our jail, and other things, other support
Michael,
staff.
Could I add one thing?
Yeah, let's, Judge Cordell, go ahead.
About measuring trust. There's another measure of trust, and that's looking at the number of and kinds of complaints that civilians bring against officers. So in San Jose, we have a civilian oversight department so that we take in complaints from members of the public. And one good gauge is what's happening with complaints. What are people complaining about? How few are how many are there? And I do not know if Hayward, Richmond, any of the other police departments have independent civilian oversight, which I think is critical to building trust between community and the police department, because when you don't have civilian oversight, you have people who the only place they can do is they go to the police to complain about the police, and there's no oversight over those investigations. I firmly believe, after being in this job for 5 years in San Jose, that having independent civilian oversight is absolutely critical to building trust between the police and the community.
All right, I want to extend thanks to Alwin Brown. Did you have a final word, though? We're coming up on a break, Chief Brown.
Yeah, I was just going to say I'd have to agree with that. We've had independent civilian oversight of police here in Richmond for about 20 years, and members of the public can make complaints directly with our
Deputy Chief Alwin Brown, City of Richmond, thank you for joining us. And we will have you, our listeners, join us. In fact, give you the opportunity to be part of this conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available now, and you can join us now by phone at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We'll continue with Judge Ladoris Cordell, Justin McCrary, and you, our listeners, when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the fact that white police officers predominate on Bay Area police forces and what that means and what can be done to remedy it, but also what can be done to make police forces in general more responsive culturally and every other way to the communities they serve. Recent analysis of the latest census data says that more than 80% of Bay Area police forces have a disproportionate number of white officers relative to the racial makeup of the communities they serve. And that disparity is pretty stark in places like Daly City, which has a white population of just 14%, but a police force of 100% white. Judge Ladoris Cordell is with us, independent police auditor with the City of San Jose and a Santa Clara County Superior Court judge and also a Palo Alto City Councilwoman, previously served in both those capacities. Justin McCrary is with us in studio. He's a law professor at UC Berkeley and also directs the D-Lab, which is Berkeley's Big Data Initiative, and the co-director of the Crime Working Group of the National Bureau of Economic Research. We spoke with the chief of the Hayward Police, Diane Urban, and we spoke with the deputy chief of the Richmond Police Department, Alwyn Brown, and we welcome your involvement in the program. In fact, invite you to join us either by phone, toll-free at 866-733-6786 if you'd like to register your own thoughts or feelings about this, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Just a quick note that I wanted to get into with you, Justin McCrary. This article that appeared in the San Jose Mercury News based on these census figures, there are a number of police departments which are disputing them. And let's just get to the fact here that, for example, they say that there are no police officers of color in Napa, which is not true. And they say there are none in Novato, there are none in Walnut Creek, Brentwood, and Antioch. I don't know. We're going to. But this is old data that they're dealing with here, really.
It's not just that it's old data. They're using census data, which is not a good way to measure the racial composition of the police force. In fact, if you read the comments to the article itself, a lot of the people who were writing in with comments were themselves police officers, and they said, why are they talking about estimates of the fraction of the police force that's African American? Why don't they just ask the police department? And it turns out there's a variety of data sets that are collected that have direct information directly from the police department, not indirect estimates from the census. If you look at those kinds of figures, it's probably right that you'd fix up some of the specific numbers, like, say, the numbers for Daly City or for Napa. On the other hand, the overall thrust of the conclusions is probably about right, that the vast majority of police departments have more white officers than you would have guessed just based on the fraction of the population that's white.
Let me go to an online comment and get your response to this, Justin McCrary. This is from a former police officer who says, as a black man, I'm tired of hearing, if we want minority police officers, we have to dumb down the exams. How is the public served with less educated officers? And stop assuming minorities can't pass a standardized achievement test. I was a police officer in New York City in the 1970s. They did not change the exam for me or any other minority, and somehow I and they passed. We're in a second generation of exams now, we should mention, are we not?
Yes. No, I think that's right. It certainly was true circa 1965, circa 1970, that many police departments were quite literally using an IQ test or an achievement test of some sort. The Detroit Police Department into the 1970s was using the Otis IQ test. The Washington Police Department for a long time was using the same civil servants exam that they gave to the Postal Service employees.
And there are a lot of Postal Service employees of color.
Yes, there are.
So predominant, maybe, in some areas.
If you look at the exam that was being used by the Washington Police Department around 1970, they were using an exam that would basically just go through and ask you questions about vocabulary, for example, definitions of words that nobody needed to know, like promontory. If you look at second-generation tests, these were tests that police departments developed in conjunction with psychologists, primarily industrial organization psychologists, that specifically were trying to see if they could measure job performance. And one of the basic challenges confronting police departments in hiring a diverse workforce is that the disparity in test scores was basically as large after the implementation of more rigorous job performance assessments as it was beforehand. And one of the difficulties that police departments have had throughout this time period, 1970 until today, is that figuring out what it means to be a good police officer is a very challenging thing. Most people actually don't quite know how to measure trust in the community. And certainly we don't know how to measure whether someone who is considering becoming a police officer is going to be helpful in that regard. We have no basic way right now in any police department entrance examination of assessing whether an individual is likely to be susceptible to unconscious bias of the type that the judge was describing earlier, and that
or just how empathic, how compassionate, how reasonable in terms of dealing with crisis situations an individual. These are things that are almost in some ways impossible to test. But what about I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment, but Judge Cordell, I want to get you on record on something. David writes and raises an important question. He says, wants to know about data on where the officers live. I mean, But he asks, should there be incentives to live where you serve, perhaps including private school tuition, officers, kids in the neighborhoods where the schools are bad? Should it be, in other words, a requirement for the officer to be a part of that community? Judge Cordell?
I think it's a terrific idea. I don't think it's possible, because if you look at the housing prices, that's why officers in San Jose can't really live close to where they work. Many of them have to travel from distant places because they just can't afford it. But a really good example is the example of East Palo Alto, which for a long time was unincorporated, the southernmost part of San Mateo County that was policed by members of the sheriff's department. None of those folks lived in East Palo Alto, and as a result, they really had no connection to people, and there were complaints. And I lived in East Palo Alto, so I know of what I speak about this. There were complaints about how the police were dealing with folks, and then eventually when the city incorporated in 1983 and then had their own police force, things dramatically changed. So it is important to have that connection. And I wish that officers could live in their communities, but I think it's just not economically feasible for them.
Well, I'm going to go to your calls. Just one email I want to read here. Bill says, women are less likely than men and want to be tough guys as police. I'd especially like to see more women as police officers, as women usually approach things with more tact. Let me go to your calls, and we'll begin, Sablin, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, am I on the air?
Sabian, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes. Well, I'm a former police officer. I worked with Judge Cordell in San Jose, and she has an amazing point of officers being part of the community. Being a former black police officer, whenever I went to a disturbance involving black or brown people, the white police officers would react differently because they never grew up in that environment. For example, if I could go to a black housing noise disturbance when people are just happy and loud and being gregarious, it is taken as a threat to a white police officer because they never grew up in that environment. And then they overreact, and it's then lead to a complaint of why was I handcuffed, why was I told to sit on the ground, when I would go to a situation and say, like, these people are just happy and they're just loud and gregarious. Yes, officer safety is important. I'm not going to downplay that, but there are certain situations where a officer of color could realize that this is not a threatening situation and actually interact with the community instead of treating everyone as us versus them. And once again, I don't want to downplay officer safety, being a former police officer, but I think having officers be part of the community, live with the community, or be part of that cultural makeup really helps in policing.
Yeah.
That's my comment.
Okay, thank you, Sabian, for that comment. Appreciate hearing from you, and I'm going to go right to another listener and get a comment or question from you. Taylor, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I think, although I acknowledge the fact that there is a racial component to it, I think the fact that there are officers of color who are in a pressure situation, in a cultural situation, also abuse other people of color trying to show that they're tough on crime just as much. And in addition to that, the militarization of giving officers certain type of guns sets a tone in communities like where I live in Oakland, where officers are using deadly force more regularly than alternatives, and it causes a sense of fear, which causes a sense of tension, which ends up causing individuals to have these unhealthy relationships with it. So I think it's also about the culture of the police station as well as the culture we use to deal with certain situations that may not need deadly force, which is why I think we have the Ferguson issue right now.
Taylor, I thank you for the call. And another important point from a listener. We'll go to more of your points here, but here's one online from a listener. It says, and Judge Cordell, let me defer to you on this. Can individuals who have been arrested, convicted of any crime join the police force? If not, doesn't this sharply reduce the number of eligible minorities? I understand rates of conviction and arrest are much higher for minorities. It's a point, but presently it would be impossible for somebody with a record, wouldn't it, to join a police force?
Sure.
Should that be changed, altered?
Well, generally speaking, I don't believe that any police department is going to allow someone who has got a felony conviction, and I say felony because it's, you know, far more serious than a misdemeanor. There perhaps are officers who maybe had some run-ins with the law when they were very, very young, you know, and got a misdemeanor for something, and I don't think that should stop them, and I don't think in most case instances it does. But this caller or the person who wrote in begs the question, because the question is really getting to younger people when they're in middle school, they're in high school, so they don't end up with criminal records so that they are eligible then if they want to go into law enforcement. So it's really about getting officers at interacting with young people at those stages so that they are seen as role models and not seen as the enemy.
Let me go to a caller who's joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. David is a former police chief in Madison, probably decades before I was there. I was there during the first incarnation of Paul Soglin's mayorship. But welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hello. I actually was appointed by a conservative commission before Paul Soglin was elected mayor.
Well, he had two incarnations. His first one was back in the
Sure.
Yeah.
So let me just say that diversification is so incredibly essential. It is the major component of police departments. If you don't have a diversified police department, I mean women as well as people of color, you're in deep, deep trouble to do anything with the community. And the fact is it takes so long. It took us at least 10 years. When I came in the department, we had one black officer. We had no women uniformed in patrol. And it took at least 10 years of me setting a standard that said that half of our recruit class had to be women or people of color. And I had to maintain that standard for 20 years. Otherwise, we would have fallen backwards. And that takes commitment from the entire city and not just the police chief. You know, people are committed to diversity. They can do it. They can hire good people, and we can start to turn things around. But all this stuff was told us in 1968 with the Curtis Commission. Curtis Commission pointed out the problems and disparities in white police departments, and we're still struggling with that today. And I think it's a tragedy.
All right, David, I appreciate your contribution to the conversation here, and I'm going to go to more callers shortly and more of your emails. But I want to go first to Mountain View. Captain Jessica Nowoski is captain of the Mountain View Police Force, and she joins us by phone this morning. Captain Nowoski, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on your show.
Good morning. Glad to have you. And what's the situation in Mountain View? Can you give us a sense of officers of color as opposed to the community and what the community is like vis-a-vis those numbers?
Yes. Well, we actually have a pretty diverse community. You know, we're home to Google and LinkedIn and other IT and high-tech corporations. So it does attract people from all over the world, in fact. And so we're very aware of that, and we always try to recruit and hire a diverse population of officers. And that does not come without its challenges, but one thing that we recognize, and specifically from my perspective as the personnel captain, is that it doesn't just come down to race, although that's an important factor as well, and gender. We take those into consideration. But I look for people that have life experience and a little bit of grit. I actually grew up in Richmond myself, so I have an interesting background. Although I'm a Caucasian female, I definitely have a little bit different perspective on different communities and a diverse community myself from my own experience.
If I may say, there's a major kind of class difference, isn't there, between, say, a place like Richmond and a place like Mountain View? How much does class figure into policing from your perspective?
You know, it's hard to say because there are so many psychological factors that come into such a complicated field like law enforcement. We're basically dealing with people, and people are complicated things. So it's very difficult to say how much it plays a role. I think that value systems and what groups of people prioritize and what they find important in their life definitely makes a difference in how they respond to the police and how they like to be spoken to or treated. So we come across all different types. It's a very interesting community here. You have one side of town that's particularly more affluent than another side of town that is very dense in apartment building complexes. And so you do come across a much different community from just one side of town to the other.
Well, how much of your training with respect to culture emphasizes that, emphasizes the humanity of how police officers ought to be aware when they're dealing with citizens?
I think that's the secret sauce. I think that's the one thing that could level the playing field with the different officers from no matter what ethnicity or gender or background is the training. And we put quite a bit of emphasis in the training. In fact, we went several years ago from training our officers on a biannual basis, a week at a time, to training our officers every other month. They take a whole entire day. It's called CPT. And we train them in a variety of different, we have post mandates that we have to do, but we're always sensitive to what is going to make them more effective police officers. And because we realize that we're really in the people business, we have to understand people. And to understand people, we have to know what our community needs from us. And one of the ways that we measure our success with trust with the community is through all of our numerous social media channels. We don't shy away from the negative comments, and although very rare, we diligently research the complaints and make online whatever comes in through the front door, as well as our online complaints as well. And we deal with people that have, you know, anywhere from a positive to a negative experience in a very open manner.
And what do you do about recruitment?
Recruiting, you know, that's an interesting thing, too. As you know, in the economy over the last 5 to 6 years, specifically in the Bay Area, we, as our department, you were about 100 sworn, 96 sworn, we haven't really had to focus on recruiting for entry level, because there's been so many police departments in our region that have been laying off officers. So we have fully trained lateral police officer candidates that we have been hiring. So we've done quite a bit of lateral hiring over the last few years, and just until recently has that slowed down, and now we're looking at recruiting more of a wide, diverse entry-level population. And we've got plans to reach out to the athletic programs in community colleges and four-year universities in the area, as well as looking at professional sports organizations for recruitment.
Again, Jessica Nowoski is captain of the Mountain View Police Department. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're going to go to more of your calls and your emails. In fact, let me go to a couple of online comments. Listener writes, for the middle class, majority of whom are white, I did a little editing there, a police officer is a person who helps, is there when you're in need. For lower income, majority of which are black or Hispanic, police officer is a person of fear, one who takes away loved ones and is not there to help but to harm. Why would you want to grow up to be a person like that? It's not a noble profession for people whose history with officers is so negative. And another email here that kind of dovetails with that. Any chance you can address the bias toward police officers from the public, not just racial bias that may or may not exist in an officer's mind? It was sort of dovetail for me, Judge Cordell, because we're talking about the perception of police officers from the standpoint or from the viewpoint of those in the community. And sometimes it is obviously biased, and certainly it doesn't help in terms of recruitment. Although I think the listener's comments were pretty much too general. There are a lot of people of color who welcome the police and who look toward the police for leadership and help and so forth. But could you address the problem of public bias here, citizen bias?
Absolutely. I mean, race brings with it baggage on both sides. So if we talk about communities of color, there's no question that people of color, I'm not speaking very generally, stereotype. First of all, we all stereotype, no matter what our color. We stereotype. That's how part of how we survive. And the stereotyping with regard to law enforcement often is negative. There can be positive stereotypes, obviously, but oftentimes it's negative. Well, why is it negative? Well, it's because of history. It's because of the long, you know, history of how race has I can't even say developed, but have kind of evolved in this country. So it can't be just viewed in isolation. But we do. There's baggage on that side. And then there's baggage on the law enforcement side, again, dealing with race, about stereotypes. And when you see someone, what is it you think? And do you all of a sudden, you know, feel the fear? And why do you feel that fear on the side of community members? These are issues that absolutely now, that need to be grappled with. We really need, in addition to having conversations, we need to do, you know, get in and get some practical things, make them happen, such as the training of officers, such as recruiting, such as transparency. I think, Michael, you raised the issue of transparency. That's critical to building trust. So it's important that the public knows how these police departments operate. In San Jose, they have a duty manual that has all the rules for the police. In San Jose, and I think it's rare among police departments, their duty manual is online. If you were to go to our website or go to the San Jose Police Department website, on their homepage, you can click a button and read the rules that guide the police. And you cannot do that in just about any other police department. Certainly, I've checked in the Bay Area. So where is it? If you want to start building trust, police chiefs, you know, get your manuals, your generals online so everyone in the public can know, you know, what's the definition of reasonable force or excessive force? What are the rules for search and seizure? Put them out there so the public can know.
And Judge Lidores Cordell is independent police auditor with the city of San Jose. And when she mentions pushing a little button, Justin McCrary, I'm looking at an email here from Vlad who says, what about mandating all police officers wear little button cameras on their chests? That way they are monitored when they protect and serve.
We could do something like that, but then we'd have to talk about how to pay for it and whether it would be valuable to have the camera on the chest as opposed to having an extra few officers. That's the basic trade-off that every police department confronts is they come in with a fixed budget, and most of the time part of the issue that they're confronting with respect to trust is not something that exists in a vacuum. It exists in part because the police department doesn't have the funds to have officers on the street as much as they would like. Usually police officers are in cars because they need to cover a larger amount of territory than they would be able to cover on foot. So I think there's a challenge there with respect to utilizing technology, which is it's expensive and police departments are chronically underfunded.
If I have to take issue, if I could, Michael,
yeah,
with this issue on cameras. I've been crusading for cameras for the last 3.5 years. I think that every law enforcement officer should be required to wear body-worn cameras. And the cost is there's federal money, there's grant money to because it's a one-time expenditure. The cameras are down to now about $395, $400 per camera. The issue, though, is it is a big mistake to go and just buy up cameras and put them on police officers. The first thing that should happen is that every police department should have a protocol of when the cameras get turned on, when do they get turned off, who has access to the data, how long is the data stored. All of that should be written up in a protocol and made public. Again, transparency. And once you have a tight protocol, then it's time to get the cameras. That is exactly what the San Jose Police Department is doing. They are studying the issue. They're looking at best practices. They're developing the tightest protocol with input from a variety of stakeholders. And then their plan is, again, locating the money, and I believe there is federal money available to do this, to then equip the officers with cameras. Cell phones have changed policing forever, and that's where all this really started, with video by civilians, videotaping, using cell phones to tape and record. And so it is absolutely appropriate and I think essential for policing that there be these body-worn cameras.
But, you know, you mentioned, Judge Cordell, history in all of this, and I can't help thinking, even though things have changed in a quantum way with all the new technology, certainly one thinks about the Rodney King event, but even Oscar Grant or Michael Brown, they're all tied also to the kind of social media that erupts after this. I mean, communities will erupt as they had, say, in Watts and so many places during the late 60s. But now there's that different component, and history plays its role here because of not only the adversarial relationship that has existed and goes way back with police. I mean, think about Bull Connor and all those names that come to mind, police being brutal in communities of color. But now you got the social media, too.
Well, I don't think that social media is a problem. I don't see it as being problematic to policing. It's just a fact. It is a fact that now people can communicate quickly, and so be it.
But it can inflame passions to a much greater and quicker degree. I mean, we see this in the Arab Spring. We see it here in probably in Missouri.
Well, sometimes inflaming passions is a good thing. To get people concerned, to get people alerted to what is happening. But the idea, however, is that if, for example, there were body-worn cameras, people tend to behave better when they know they are being recorded. That is on the civilian side as well as on the law enforcement side. So the hope is when we step up and use this technology that we won't have that concern as much in terms of the people being, you know, inflamed and the wrong things, the wrong messages going out.
No, I'm with you on the video side. I think we're talking about video as opposed to messages that are sent online, and some of those messages distort the facts. I mean, we know with the Internet that we have a constant distortion of facts going on.
Yeah, and it's over something over which we have no control. So it's a fact of life. We're going to have to figure out how to work with it.
Well, we'll work with some more of your calls. Frank joining us next. Frank, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you. I wanted to get back to this issue of training. And I assuming you've got your racially diverse cadet class, as a 30-year visitor, if you will, from Washington, D.C., I've been struck by the number of times that various area police departments have had what I would consider training scandals or accusations where there's seen an institutional cadre of senior officers who are the field trainers who are inculcating the recruits with a very aggressive mindset toward against the community. And does that match your experience? And B, could you describe what you see as institutional structural reasons why those kind of cadres tend to show up over and over again? It's not just limited to one police department.
I think what this caller is talking about are all the police departments, most of them have FTOs or field training officers. And usually these are the more experienced officers who will then take recruits under their wings when they're out on patrol to get them to, you know, learn about policing and to learn about the community. And are there instances where field training officers are perhaps giving signals to recruits about, you know, various ethnicities, groups, communities, communities of color? Sure, I'm sure that happens. But I think in the main, when there's good leadership in a police department, there's good oversight over the field training officers. And so, as one of your guests, that I think it was the deputy chief, spoke about, and also the captain, policing is a people job. And there are going to be different kinds of viewpoints. But I think in the main, if you have very, very good leadership top down in your police department, your field training officers, who I think are critical to the work, basically, they do a good job. What do they need? They need to make sure they have an understanding about bias, that they understand that we all have these unconscious biases and need to figure out how to address them.
We will have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the hour, but you can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Thanks to Judge Ladoris Cordell, independent police auditor with the City of San Jose. Previously, she was a Santa Clara County Superior Court judge and a Palo Alto City Councilwoman. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And thanks to Justin McCrary here in studio, professor of law at UC Berkeley and director of the D-Lab, Berkeley's Big Data Initiative, and the co-director of the Crime Working Group of the National Bureau of Economic Research. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to Diane Urban from the Hayward Police Department, Alwyn Brown from the Richmond Police Department, and Jessica Nowoski of the Mountain View Department. And thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.